Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Meine Damen und Herren, willkommen zu Das Flixwise Podcast. Ich bin Ihr Host und Master of Ceremonies, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today are two ladies. First up, we have the international sensation, Fräulein Anne-Marie Kelly. Say hi.
Hi.
Listeners will recall that Anne-Marie Kelly's ongoing series of essays on the forks of Katharine Hepburn was one of my final notes of positivity for the Seven Samurai podcast. They laughed. They said it couldn't be done. And yet here she is on the podcast. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And making her FlixWise debut is the film and TV professor at La Sierra University and the creator and editor of ClassicFilmFan.com. Ladies and gentlemen, the divinely decadent Frau Carrie Specht.
Is the German on my account?
Yeah.
It's all about you.
Thank you. Vielen Dank.
On the Singing in the Rain podcast, I teased that there would soon be a FlixWise musical marathon. Well, listeners can finally exhale, because on today's show, I'm going to offer up the first musical entry for the FlixWise favorites list. Are you ready?
Yes.
Wunderbar! In case the intro didn't make it perfectly obvious, the first film I'd like to discuss for the FlixWise musical marathon is the 1973 Bob Fosse film, Cabaret. Cabaret is likely the most joyous, effervescent film about self-delusion, ignorance, bigotry, and the rise of Nazism that you are ever likely to see.
It's a heck of a combo.
Yeah. It takes place in Berlin during the early 1930s. Even casual historians will recall that this is something of a contentious time for Deutschland. It's the waning days of the Weimar Republic and the infancy of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which was headed up by that Hitler guy.
I'm starting to catch on to the German theme here.
Yeah. There's propaganda and protest in the air, but all that Nazi business takes a back seat, at least initially. The film primarily centers on a couple of denizens of a cabaret joint called the Kit Kat Club, specifically an American aspiring singer/actress named Sally Bowles, played by one of the reigning queens of the universe, Miss Liza Minnelli, and Sally's new roommate and friend, Brian Roberts, played by Michael York, who's fresh off the train from Cambridge, England. The pair spend their days hustling, Sally for potential movie producers who will give her a big break, and Brian for new students that he can tutor in English. But at night, they can both be found at the cabaret. Sally dutifully performs alongside the gleeful yet sinister MC, played by Joel Grey, while Brian has his world rocked by all manner of sexual deviance. Drag queens, sadomasochism, orgies, oh my! Every now and then, a Nazi rabble-rouser comes into the club, but they are promptly escorted out before any of the fun is spoiled. About a third of the way into the movie, Sally and Brian strike up a romantic relationship, which, like everything else in this movie, feels doomed from the start. The pair seem like a mismatch, primarily because Sally is kind of a hopeless narcissist, and partially because Brian's pretty sure he's not super into sleeping with ladies. But despite any resistance or reasoning, the two wrap themselves up in a cocoon of fanciful bliss. Meanwhile, the Nazi menace has been slowly shifting from the background to the foreground. They've become less of a nuisance and more of an imminent danger. The world has changed, a fact which Brian's conscience will no longer allow him to ignore. When he finally decides to speak out, he ends up getting beat up by a pair of Nazi thugs. After the beating, Brian determines that he must leave Germany. This is, of course, complicated by his love for Sally, whom he tries to convince to join him and start a family in England. However, Sally is doggedly determined to live a life of glamour, opulence, and fame, no matter the price. At the end of the film, Brian heads back to England, leaving Sally behind. Delusional to the end, Sally spends the remaining moments of the film inside the now Nazi-infested Kit Kat Club, belting out the titular show-stopping number in which she extols the virtues of responsibility shirking and willful ignorance. Now I know what you're thinking. Lady P, this is a musical marathon. Why did it take you 5 minutes to mention a specific song? Well, hold your horses. I'm getting to it. One of the reasons I think that Cabaret is a cut above the rest is because of its seamless incorporation of the musical numbers. The songs, which are primarily sung in the Kit Kat Club, are all part of an actual performance. Fosse cuts between the musical acts in the club to a thematically related event taking place in the outside world. The club becomes a microcosm which highlights the turmoil both of our main characters and of the geopolitical atmosphere of the time. The structure of the movie is genius. Really everything about the movie is genius. I know this might sound a tad hyperbolic, but this is a perfect movie. It's beautifully shot, it's dynamic, it's kinetic, it's fun, it's scary, it's emotional, the songs are amazing, and it's ridiculous that it's not on the sight and sound poll. This fact alone justifies my putting together this alternate list to right this egregious wrong. I hope you both agree that Cabaret merits a spot on the FlixWise favorites list.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Well done.
Absolutely.
My work here is
Enough
done.
Said. That was yeah.
Okay, I'll just show myself out there. Like,
can't argue with that.
All right. So I take it you guys like the movie.
Love it.
All right. I think you actually hit on just about every point one can be made about that film. Liza Minnelli was at her absolute height of talents, and let alone popularity, and also being of the time in the 70s. She was like, wasn't she like the it girl for the period? And then the fact that the 70s really is a reflection of the late 20s, early 30s. What talk about perfect casting, being in the right place at the right time. I don't think she could have ever, I don't know if any actress could have ever had a better suited role for them than she did for that film.
Right. It does feel like she was made to play that part. How do you feel about Sally? Do you like her as a character? I know some people are really turned off by her.
I mean, she's a selfish narcissist, and that's absolutely what she is. Although they certainly shaped it for Liza Minnelli, because in the Broadway show, they changed a lot from the show, rightfully so. Fosse did a great job with that. In the show, she's British.
Mm, yeah.
Which is why she was played by Natasha Richardson, I think, in the revival.
I always wondered how they made that fit. I did not know that fact.
She was originally British, and they changed it for Minnelli because, like you said, she was the it girl. She fit so perfectly into it. And through movies like Arthur, she was playing these not-so-likable characters.
Right,
and Sally
flighty.
But she always made them likable.
But because she was Liza Minnelli and had the big doe eyes, and how could you not trust the big doe eyes and the big, beautiful voice? I guess she's not particularly likable, but you can understand in that climate how she would become the way she is and how much she wants what she wants.
Right.
Well, isn't she supposed to be somewhat representative of the U.S.? Even though the character was originally supposed to be British, her character here is kind of represents the U.S. at that time period in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that makes perfect sense that they would switch the nationality of the character. It really works in that way. Sort of the American, I guess we can talk about the historical context, in case you missed 11th grade history.
or didn't see
Schindler's List. The U.S. was sort of staying out of the Europe for during this period, so it makes sense that...
Casablanca would be a good one to see, too.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. I fell in love with Liza Minnelli after watching this movie. There's something... Yes, she's incredibly selfish, and... The persona, that Sally Bowles persona that she creates, I mean, you're either going to be taken with it or find it obnoxious. I was personally very taken with it, and I still, to this day, will greet people by saying, hello, darling.
Well, I found her obnoxious but likable. Honestly, I'm one of those few people who cannot stand Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. I love Vivien Leigh, but I cannot stand Scarlett. If Liza Minnelli had played Scarlett, I might have liked her more.
Wow.
That's a statement.
Wow. I think we're going to have to fight about that. That'll be another podcast. We'll talk about the films of 1939 coming up. So
I'll be there.
Okay. Oh. But I think she really wins you over again, like you say, with the doe eyes and the voice, where it'll just sort of, she'll come out of that affected, almost, I don't even know if it's like faux British. I don't know what she's doing. But suddenly she'll, when she's being earnest, she sounds remarkably like her mother. Mm-hmm. And I think that really...
And looks, too. It's in those moments where you're like, oh my gosh, it's Judy. It's Judy.
It's the darker shadow of Judy. Yeah. I don't mean shadow in a bad way.
Well, I think it's everything that her mother would have been as an actress had she had the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And Liza had the opportunity to show that. Yeah. Whereas her mother never did.
Yeah.
And there's just something playful and sweet about Sally. Like, the movie is so dark and unrelentingly dark. And the fact that you have one character who is willfully ignorant of it should be probably more worrisome, or not worrisome, but should be more dangerous than it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dangerous than it is, but... it's nice to have one ray of sunshine, even if it's a very misbegotten ray.
Well, you also have to remember that not only in the 30s when this is set, but also still in the 70s, women were still, it was acceptable if a woman didn't understand what was happening in the world. They weren't expected to know what was happening in the world. Mm-hmm. So it comes, you're more likely to accept it from a female as opposed to a man, because a man would have no reason for not understanding the politics of everything in the world, because men are supposed to know
there
everything.
There are plenty of ignorant men in that movie.
Yeah. But the women are supposed to be just pretty little things, and she is the absolute epitome of that. She's supposed to be, women were supposed to be accomplished, and she is accomplished as an entertainer. Basically, you know, women were supposed to be like geishas. You know, they're supposed to entertain but not know anything mm-hmm. or say anything yeah. about politics. And that's what she is, mm-hmm. absolutely 100%. So you accept it, though it would be interesting to see what audiences today would think of it who have no concept or no knowledge of that world of women being seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think she does display an intelligence and a knowing. I think she is well aware of what's happening, especially when it comes to the ending with the mm-hmm. the abortion. Like, she is able to, I mean, she understands what she's good for, what her strengths are, mm-hmm. and she's absolutely going to play into those mm-hmm. strengths, mm-hmm. and one of those strengths is not going to be motherhood for her, and I think she's very aware of that.
I mean, it's willful ignorance. Yeah. She knows. There's some part of her that knows what's going on. It's like right. the conversation she, that mm-hmm. she has where she's going on and on about how she's going to get married to Max. Maximilian. Where she's the just barely this side of okay version, censorship version of saying, well, no, you're not, because he slept with me. Yeah. And there's a moment where you watch it, like the knowledge of that cross her face, and then it goes off again. Like, she knows what's going mm-hmm. on. She's just mm-hmm. not going to acknowledge it.
Right.
Well, and I guess I should have taken a step further, when I was talking about that scene and I heard, her character almost longs for that. She wants to be ignorant. She just wants to be a plaything because mm-hmm. things are easier that way. And there are those moments, you talked about it a little earlier, that knowledgeable moments in her eyes where it's very vulnerable and she's almost saying to whatever character she's speaking to, you see what I'm talking about. I'm exposing myself here. Please let me be who I am because I'm not going to be able to function
right.
in this world the way it is
right.
any other way.
Right, yeah. Someone once told me that they felt like the Kit Kat Club is sort of a representation of hell and that the MC is the devil.
Ooh.
Do you guys buy that?
Hmm.
Any credence to that?
He's a Mephistopheles-esque character, certainly. That's such a broad definition for that character and such a broad reading for that movie that's so site-specific.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think everybody's having too much fun.
Yeah.
Hell.
It's hedonism.
Yeah. Hedonism, perhaps. Maybe they're supposed to be in limbo.
Yeah.
They're in Lost. Mm. The TV show Lost.
There's a polar bear about to walk across the stage.
Some kind of wind monster. But no, he's definitely, he's almost like a puppet master. Mm-hmm. He's almost like a hypnotist, mm-hmm. For saying, forget about the outside world, forget about the outside world. And in a way, if anything, I wouldn't say he was the devil. I'd say he's Hitler, you know, which some people would equate to being the same thing. But he's like saying, don't look over there, look over here. Almost like a masked magician who's trying to misdirect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everything's going to be okay as long as we just ignore all the horrible things that are getting closer and closer and closer to us.
Right.
So, and he's asking them to narrow their view more and more and more so that they, as you said, it's hedonistic. Let's just worry about ourselves and our own pleasures.
Right.
And
right.
forget about everybody else.
Right.
Although, even when he does that, he still sneaks in, like the, if you could see her through my eyes, the entire dance number with the monkey. Like, he's saying, don't look over there, look over here. But at the same time, slyly making you aware. I mean, it's the intercutting that Fosse so brilliantly does between the scenes of anti-Semitism and then that song, or the scenes of the song Money, 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 mm-hmm. and then intercutting it with the scenes of people getting paid off.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a meta-commentary that's happening at the same time, too, so that it works on two levels where you could just, not the way Fosse does it, but the songs themselves could theoretically work in a way where you don't realize what's happening on, like, you don't realize what he's talking about, but Fosse doesn't let you look away. Like, the MC says look away, but Fosse doesn't let you.
Right. Right.
There's a dance number with a monkey?
Yeah. If you could see her through my eyes.
Fosse does everything.
He sings, he dances, often at the same time.
Sorry, that was a spam lot quote. Sorry. So let's talk about Bob Fosse. This movie, in some ways, I feel like this movie was kind of a death knell for the Hollywood musical. And a celebration as well. It sort of pays tribute to other musicals, perhaps. I feel like it's closer in spirit to a Busby Berkeley musical than it is to, say, Sound of Music, even though there mm-hmm. are certainly more Nazis in Sound of Music than there are in Gold Diggers. But just stylistically.
Are we sure about that?
Yeah, well, you never know.
No, it's interesting you should say that. I wouldn't say death knell. Mm-hmm. I would say bookend.
Okay.
For many reasons, and actually, just when you were saying what you were just saying, it made me think, wow, there's actually quite a bit of connection between the movies of the 1930s, of course, because that's when this is set, and in a strange way, a loving homage to them, mm-hmm. and also saying, guys, we've been doing this escapism entertainment for a really long time.
Right.
This is nothing new. We're just showing you the dark side of it.
Right.
And not just what's happening behind the scenes, but in a way, the dangers of escapism and why all those musicals in the 1930s may not have been such a great thing. To keep people from paying attention to what was happening in the world.
Yeah, it's basically taking the form of the 1930s musical, like the 1930s backstage musical, mm-hmm. which is specifically, let's put on a show. And right. like the I don't know what you would call it, the libido of the main characters, like the desire of the main characters to get together is also the desire of the show to come together. Mm-hmm. And it's all very light and fluffy and happy. And every part of that like specific construct gets deconstructed by this movie, gets absolutely mm-hmm. torn apart limb by limb from this movie.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, and Fosse would be the person to do it since Fosse was at the tail end of the studio era and worked on, you know, Kiss Me Kate uh-huh. and was it My Sister Eileen, the musical version. And he was a choreographer and then also a performer. And so he took what he knew. I don't know if he worked with Busby Berkeley, because if there was any crossover there, but of course he must have been influenced, certainly. And then basically tweaking it to its extremes, especially when you go on to one of his later films, which would have been All That Jazz. But he is really pushing it for all it's worth in this film. And yeah, I would call it a bookend. Kind of like, you know, how noir has a set bookends, even though we now have this neo-noir happening and for several years. I would say the musical, which we know is back because Chicago won Best right. Picture in 2002, mm-hmm. It definitely took a break.
Yes. You
know, I would say Annie was the death knell.
Ah, okay. Oh. Fair enough. Yeah. Okay.
This is a bookend.
So I think it has its defenders. But there are specific shots that feel like, if not direct ripoffs, then tributes to the earlier
homage,
precisely. We even get a shot through a couple of dancers' legs and all mm-hmm. that stuff. So,
very, very Busby Berkeley. Mm-hmm.
And Anne Marie and I were talking prior to this podcast about the use of Zooms and mm-hmm. how they're
and your
to
love
be,
of them.
Yes, we adore them, obviously. And even in this movie, during the 70s, like directors had a new toy and they had to use it at every opportunity. And Bob Fosse was no exception. however, we sort of were a little bit critical of the overuse of the Zoom, but I do think that it's used well in this movie. But it's very subtle, and I think the one use that I really liked was during the Maybe This Time segment, or that song where they zoom out to reveal the empty club. Mm-hmm. So it's this very hopeful song, and then you zoom out and you realize
there's nobody there.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I don't know. For me, if there was ever good use of the Zoom during the 70s. I again, like you said, they used it because they could. And for me, if you're going to do a shot like that, you should use a dolly. Mm-hmm. But you know, then, are you, if you're on a location, is there enough room to use a dolly? Are you on a stage, in which case you can use the dolly and make room for it? But the problem, because it was a new toy, people misused it, and you always got this weird sense that it was a Zoom. Mm-hmm. Whereas nowadays, the lenses are so much better that should someone choose a Zoom over a dolly move, you don't necessarily know it, unless you're an expert. Mm-hmm. And you can understand the flattening of scenes or the soft focus effects. No, me, there's no good use of a zoom in the
70s. Not even in that scene?
Not for me.
Okay.
I would have said, oh man, why are they not using a dolly?
Mm.
The only reason I respectfully disagree with that is because of the claustrophobia that Fosse builds into the stage in Cabaret. You get the sense watching Cabaret that the stage is very small and that the club is very small, which is really the opposite of the Busby Berkeley musicals where they start like on a proscenium and then suddenly they have an entire back lot to work with. Like the staircase will just keep going right up to heaven or as far
as
that.
And it's supposed
to
be on Broadway, right?
Yeah, and it's supposed to be on Broadway, which no Broadway theater has ever been able to build anything quite that tall. So in that, I mean, so for sheer reasons of space, the zoom works slightly better for that. But I think what we all seem to be talking about is how visual of a director Bob Fosse is and how he places his camera and how he moves his camera, which is not necessarily something that you see from director turned choreographers, and definitely something he had in common with Busby Berkeley, was that he made the camera as much of an active player in the dance number, in the musical number, in anything, as he did the actual actors and dancers and singers on screen.
Well, yeah, he choreographed the camera, which a lot of directors forget about, that their camera placement is a choreography of its own.
Yeah, your classic musicals were beautiful for, you know, being able to show you absolutely everything Fred Astaire was doing because they were always keeping him in wide shot. But on the other hand, you didn't always have the camera itself moving. And while I will happily watch Fred Astaire dance all day, like that's, I have actually.
I'm glad you say that.
You lose something filmically, you lose something cinematically when you just set the camera down and let somebody else do their thing. It's the equivalent of just watching a slightly closer in Broadway musical, basically.
Yeah.
With a giant set.
Right.
Giant Busby Berkeley set.
Yeah. Also, just one stylistic note I want to make. This film boasts the greatest rack focus in cinema history. Right? You know which one I'm talking about, right?
Remind me.
The scene where Sally meets Natalia, holds out her hand, racks from her face to the chipped green nail polish. I think that's probably, I think safe to say, the greatest rack focus. Yes, yay or nay?
I think it's a good nominee.
Okay.
I would have to think about and make a list of other great rack focus moments.
Okay. I'll expect that next time. Yeah, okay. Next time I see you.
But there is, you know, that would actually not be a bad podcast, is to talk about great rack focus, because that's another thing that's misused a lot, is rack focus.
Mm. Not in this case. when I pitched this musical marathon to you guys, both of you suggested All That Jazz, which is another Bob Fosse musical. So I'm wondering if maybe we can compare the two works. And
well, in a strange way, I have to say Cabaret is the friendlier, nicer, easier to accept from any audience member, whereas All That Jazz really alienates a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's just too experimental for a lot of people, especially they go on thinking it's a musical. And it is a musical, but it's not like any musical you've ever seen before, which can be said about Cabaret, but it's a lot more closer to, you know, being accepted by grandma and grandpa or an older generation. All That Jazz, it's so sexual. It's so personal.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Bob Fosse on the screen. It's his soul up there. And then all your deep thoughts about life, and talk about an episode of Lost, of being in limbo and purgatory and dying. And it's funky. I think you have to be a Bob Fosse fan to accept it readily.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, I think you need to see it a couple of times before you can get it and appreciate it.
Yeah. Agreed.
Even though I love it.
Yeah.
And it's a masterpiece. Yeah. I absolutely agree on all counts. Yeah. It's a really difficult movie to get into, especially if you're not familiar with Bob Fosse, especially if you're just not familiar with theatrical convention, because in so many ways, not just with the takeoff with us, like, highly sexualized scene, but just in the scene where the producers are arguing about whether to lose the Fosse character, and there are those colors shifting over them, those colors of light shifting over them, which not so subtly reflect what they're thinking and feeling in the scene. Like, a lot of what he's doing is poking at the kind of bubble of theatricality that's around musicals as a genre. And it's really difficult to watch that and absorb that if you're not familiar with and comfortable with the genre. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with and comfortable with the fact that this is what Bob Fosse does, this is what he loves doing, it's what he even did in the musical number he choreographed in Kiss Me, Kate, where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's this entire Fosse number in the middle of a very ordinary musical. That's what he did. And it's, plus the third act just kind of goes off the rails into left field. And it's brilliant to watch. It's beautiful and it's insane, but it's, yeah, it's not family friendly.
As opposed to Cabaret.
Depends on your family.
Cabaret at least has like a structure that's recognizable, yeah. I think. Yeah. when I was little, my mom actually introduced me to Cabaret by teaching me the very first part of the opening song, like up until it got sexualized, and a song about marriage that got cut from the movie, and like nothing else. So I had the impression that it was actually this really sweet musical.
Yeah, that's cute.
One could just listen to the songs and have no idea what's actually going on. They never really address any of the...
You know, it's interesting. Cabaret does rely upon the performances to really sell the overall meaning. You're right. It's not just from the words of the lyrics.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get the sense that this is a movie that even people who do not like musicals can appreciate this movie. Why do you think that is? Or do you think that's true?
I think it's true if you're... I'm gonna sort of split on this. If you're not a movie person, or I should say maybe cinema movie person, you may not like it. But if you're a cinema person as opposed to just a movie person, you are going to like it. If you like old movies and you sort of dabble this in there and you like to be experiment in your movie watching and see how things have changed over the decades and generations in cinema history, you're going to love it. I feel, though, people who maybe have only been going to the movies recently and seeing Transformers or... that always comes up as my go-to for sort of negativity.
Yeah, why is Transformers the worst movie ever? It is everyone's go-to for worst.
I think it just is iconic of the times in regards to this over-the-top special effects. Mm-hmm. And if you're just a moviegoer who goes for that kind of movie watching, you are not going to get or like Cabaret. Right. So, I don't know. I think you almost have two different audiences. But for me, I would take the chance and show it to somebody and say, let me show you something different. Let me show you what movies can do without special effects.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a movie musical in that it's a very filmic and cinematic musical. It's like a new Hollywood musical, basically. It might be the only one that is that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it also helps... People, the largest complaint that I hear against musicals now, like they just released the trailer for Into the Woods and nobody sings in the trailer for Into the Woods. Nobody. They just all like breathe, sigh the opening, I wish. And it's because there's this fear now that like people won't believe someone just randomly breaking into song on the street, which like talking about how like when you brought up Transformers or bring up Thor, like we're willing to... suspend our disbelief that a guy will fly by throwing his hammer.
Yeah.
That's how Thor flies.
Which is totally ridiculous. Yeah.
But we're not willing to suspend our disbelief that somebody like walking down the street will sing. Which, okay, fine. You know, tastes change and I get that. But in that way, Cabaret is a little bit easier to stomach because each of the musical numbers has a diegetic reason for existing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like there's the guy who, like the young little blonde Nazi who comes up to sing Tomorrow Belongs to Me. There's everybody's performing in the cabaret. Like, there's a reason for it, and that makes, since we've been talking about how unpalatable it is, that makes it a little bit easier to swallow.
Right.
Yeah, otherwise, it's maybe like put a disclaimer before you're showing this movie to people. Like, it's a musical, it's not like Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, let's put on a show.
Yeah,
let's just all know that before we go in.
Right, exactly. One final topic before I ask the last question. I want to talk about Fritz and Natalia. So much of this movie is very, very cynical, and it uses the dramatic irony to almost like look down on all of the characters. The movie is almost contemptuous of them. It loves them and it hates them. But Fritz and Natalia, it's the cruelest use of dramatic irony in the movie, and I feel like Fritz and Natalia are kind of the heart of the movie in many ways.
Yeah, that's true. What you were saying about how the film's contemptuous of the characters, and I actually think it is. It's not if is it, it is. Mm-hmm. And it's making a comment about the times, how everybody has got their heads in the sand like ostriches. just completely trying to ignore because it's not happening to them.
Right.
It's not affecting them directly.
Right.
But in the case of Fritz and Natalia, it is happening directly to them.
And here's the kicker to that. I think it works really well that they have that because in the musical, Fritz and Natalia don't exist.
Right.
The second love story is actually between the landlord, who's a woman, and the Jewish grocer. And they do not end that happily. They don't end happily at all. And so changing them to a younger couple so that they can reflect Sally and the main character, and changing them to a happier if tenuous ending, I think actually goes much further towards showing the
balance.
Balancing it out better and just kind of counterpointing the tragedy of what's going to eventually happen to Sally too.
Yeah, I think it's a glimpse of what is going to happen beyond this world and as time goes on. Because we kind of get a sense of doom.
Yeah.
Well, everything about the movie, as I mentioned, is perfect. So
makes you wonder why it didn't win Best Picture. But then when you find out what did win Best Picture, you go, aha.
I still think it should have won Best Picture, but that's just me.
And lost to a Zeitgeist movie. Like me.
Well, it is considered one of the best films ever made.
It's true.
In case you don't know what we're talking about, Godfather.
Godfather.
Coming up soon on our Sight and Sound list.
That's true.
But anyway, so Cabaret didn't make the list at all. Which, ridiculous, right?
Well, yeah, and I'd have to take a close look at the rest of the films on that list to say why. Because, as we've said, it's a very particular type film that actually represents a very particular type of filmmaking, and it makes you think there's got to be a place for that on the list. Why is there not a place for that? Unless there needs to be a place for that, it's going to have to push something else off. And I think at a cursory glance, you can probably find a couple that you're like, look, get this off the list, put this in there instead.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and we were talking about the other musicals that are on the list, and it's obviously Singing in the Rain, Wizard of Oz. Meet Me in St. Louis.
And Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Right. And really, if all of your musicals on that list are, with the exception of one, are classic Hollywood musicals, you need to kind of show what happened.
Yeah.
How it changed, how it evolved.
Well, I would even suggest replacing... Even though it's Judy Garland, I would suggest it replace. If you're just doing a straight replacement, Meet Me in St. Louis. It's a great, sweet musical. Yes, it's Vincent Minnelli.
No, I'm with her.
I say that's an easy replacement if you want to do a tit for tat.
Yeah.
Though it doesn't have to be.
I say we get rid of Melancholia, but...
Oh, wow. Melancholia's
on the list?
Yeah. Dump Melancholia and pick up Cabaret instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, so but with that in mind... Can we, at the very least, induct it into the FlixWise favorites list?
Heck yes.
All right. Yay. I say so, too.
So say we all.
Yay.
The motion passes.
Say we all. All right. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Come let us know what you think of Cabaret on our website, FlixWise.com. Or if you just want to gush over Liza Minnelli with me, you can reach me on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. Or you can catch me on Twitter at FlixWise. But before you do all that, please rate us and leave us a kind word on iTunes. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and on Stitcher. On the next podcast, listeners can anticipate another musical mini-sode with Anne-Marie pitching West Side Story, the FlixWise favorites list. And before we sign off, I do want to wish my dearest Liza a very speedy recovery. She's had a bit of an accident, I guess, so...
Yeah.
All the best to her.
Yeah. But anyway, ladies... Thank you so much for joining me for the Cabaret episode.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, auf Wiedersehen.
Tschüss.
Tschüss.